Remember, the book of Samuel was one book. It wasn't 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. It was all one great big monstrous book. Aren't you glad they cut it in half? But because you start this book as 2 Samuel and chapter 1, you can kind of get the impression that, it's kind of interesting that that these things tie so closely together. And so what I want to do is encourage you to go back and make sure you're getting in context where we are. As you continue reading through 2 Samuel, kind of as you review, I don't know what your Bible study schedule is, but I like to review. I like to read a few chapters behind where I come in and then kind of go on through instead of picking something up. So I would encourage you to just think of it as one book and just kind of, you know, pretend that we're in chapter 32 of the book of Samuel. It says, now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. Now the death of Saul, remember Saul was the king, King Saul, Israel's first king, not a great king, but the first king. You know, if you can't be called great, you might as well be called first. So he was the first king. And the Philistine-Israeli war had been gearing up, the Philistines on one side, the Israelites on the other, and they're building up, having their massive armies and stuff. And remember, David was backslidden at the time. David and his 600 mighty men, they were living in Ziklag. That was a Philistine city that a Philistine king had given him to live in. The Philistine king had actually made David his bodyguard for life. And David was showing up to the Philistine-Israeli war on the wrong side. He was showing up with the Philistines. Well, the other four kings of the Philistines, remember they had five lords of the Philistines, five major cities, and he was in, you know, with one of them. But the other four said, "What are all these Jews doing here? We're going to fight the Jews. And you bring 600 Jews to fight with us? No way. They're going home." And David was bummed, and his 600 men, they left. They went back to Ziklag. But meanwhile, what had happened was the Amalekites knew that, hey, all the Israelites, all the Philistines, they're all at this big war. The towns are virtually helpless. And so the Amalekites went to the various towns of Judah, raided them, you know, stole people and things and burned them down and went on through to Ziklag, David's city. Found out David wasn't there, the mighty men weren't there, women and children and old folks, that's all there is left. So they took all the people, they took everything of value, they burned the rest to the ground. And David, having returned home from this war, he didn't get to fight, sees the city in ruins. They went and caught the Amalekites and slaughtered them, got everything back. So that's where we are. David has now come back to Ziklag. Meanwhile, the Philistine-Israeli war was going on, and Saul and three of his four sons were killed. So David has been back at Ziklag now for 2 days. We imagine they're in some kind of rebuilding process. And it says this in verse 2, "It happened on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself." Now, clothes torn and dust on his head. Has your son ever come home like that? Clothes torn, dust on his head. You're going, "You got in a fight, didn't you?" Well, back then, your clothes being torn, your dust on your head didn't mean that you'd been in a fight. It meant that you were in mourning, that you were sad and over some death or some terrible event that had happened. You might remember Joshua and the elders of Israel when you know the story. They in Jericho, they managed to really wipe the place up, you know. But the next city, Ai, they sent the guys in. "Oh yeah, no problem. We'll kill them all there in Ai." 36 Israelites died, and the rest of them ran. And it says that Joshua and the elders of Israel, they tore their clothes and put dust on their head and wept and wailed and prayed to the Lord. They were so sad. And what's going on? People of Israel wept, and they tore their clothes and put dust on their head when they got the bright idea, remember, to send the Ark of the Covenant into the Philistine war they had before. That was a great idea, you know, and the Ark got stolen, you know. And so the people, they tore their clothes, they put dust on their head. And so it's just a sign of mourning. Let's see. Oh, we're going to get to, I don't know when we'll get to the book of Job, but we will eventually, should the Lord not rapture us in the next, oh, I don't know, 3, 4, 7, 10 years. We will get to Job, I promise. 3 weeks in Job. What do you say? 3 weeks. Somebody remind me of that. We'll do chapters 1 and 2 one week. We'll do everything else the second week. And the third week, we'll just sit around and go, boy, that was a tough book. Anyway, in Job, remember what happened to Job. What happened to Job was the devil had said, God, this Job guy only likes you because you bless him all the time. If you take that hedge of protection around him, if you let me curse him and afflict him, he'll curse you. God said, okay, here's the deal. You can't kill him. And so that hedge of protection was removed from around Job, and he was stricken with what people think was a number of diseases, including the elephant man disease, elephantiasis, they call that, all kinds of stuff, boils and all kinds of stuff, teeth falling out, bad breath, as he said, my breath is offensive to my wife, he had all kinds of stuff going on, and he was sitting there in the ash heap, scratching his boils with broken pieces of pottery, and remember, his three friends showed up. Yeah, if you've read Job, you're like, three friends with friends like that. Man, I'd rather be alone. But at first, before they opened their mouths, it says that they, when they saw him, they just said, oh, oof. And they tore their clothes and put dust on their head and sat there for days being sorrowful and not saying anything. That was the best thing they could have done. It's when they started talking that was the problem. So anyway, this guy comes with torn clothes and dust on his head. I guess I've belabored that point to death. And it came about when he came to David, he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, from where do you come? And he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. Now, if I was making a movie about this scene or this story, I know exactly how I would cast this guy. And if you haven't read ahead, let me kind of paint a picture for you. In most movies, there's a guy who you can only describe as slimy, as he's a cheat, he's an opportunist, he's a money grubber, he's a pickpocket, or a untrustworthy. Hopefully I'm painting that picture for you. He's sneaky, you don't trust him. When you're sitting in the movie theater, you're like, don't trust that guy. But all the people seem to think he's fine. But you know what I'm talking about. He's usually got a couple days growth. He hasn't shaved and his hair's greasy and, he just stole something from somebody. So, you kind of get this idea now, this Amalekite. That's the picture I want to paint for you here, that that he says, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. Now, when you think of a war, how many groups of people do you think there are? You usually think of two, right? You think of, in this case, the Philistine-Israeli war, you usually think of the Philistines and the Israelites. Well, in any given war, and it's probably true today as well, I really don't keep up on these things, but at least back then, there was another group of people, opportunists, looters, thieves. They were people that rejoiced at the thought of war because they knew they were going to make some money one way or another. See, some people make money in war by selling necessary supplies that the army has forgotten or run out of at exorbitant prices. But there's an even slimier group of people that wait for the war to start. And they watch the people fall down dead, and then they sneak in there and steal their stuff off of dead people. Pretty sick. Pretty slimy. Well, this is one of these guys. I've escaped from the camp of Israel. Well, what he's really saying is, when I was there doing what I shouldn't have been doing, when I was there, I saw that the Philistine onslaught was, they were just mowing them down, and so I hightailed it on out of there. But they don't know this yet. He's trying to make it sound like, oh, I'm on your side. Yeah, I was fighting there along with Israel. And David said to him, how did things go? Please tell me. And he said, the people have fled from the battle. And also many of the people have fallen and are dead And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. But David said to the young man who told him, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? And the young man who told him said, well, by chance, I happen to be on Mount Gilboa. By chance, I happen to be right in the middle of a war. And behold, Saul was leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind me, he saw me and called to me. He said, and I said, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. Then he said to me, please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because my life still lingers in me. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. For some reason, this section of Scripture has been seized upon by people who don't believe that the Bible is the Word of God, people who want to discredit the Bible, people who want to say, oh, that's not from God. That's just a bunch of stories written by men over thousands of years. You can't trust that. It's full of contradictions. And here's an example. Look at this. Back in that other book, 1 Samuel, in that other book, it said how Saul had killed himself. And here in this other book, it must have been written by somebody else, didn't know the whole story. They got this other account of how Saul died. And so they say, well, see, it's a contradiction. It can't be inspired by God because there's two completely different stories about how this guy died. And maybe you've heard that before from some people who doubt. They usually catch on to two or three of these things. And you know, a lot of times Christians haven't been educated. They haven't read their Bible and go, oh, man, I don't know what to tell you. All I know is Jesus died for me, you know, but I don't know anything about that. But let me tell you why this is not only is it not a contradiction, it's not a valid thing. Number one, we already talked about it. Samuel's one book. It's written by one guy. And if you look at it, the accounts of Saul's death are only two paragraphs apart. So it's not like, oh, look, it's a total contradiction. It was the two authors messed up. Well, no, the same guy was writing it probably 10 minutes after he wrote the first one. He wrote the second one down. It's not a contradiction. It's not like two different guys didn't get their stories straight. The other thing is that when they read this, they assume that the Amalekite's telling the truth. You know, have you thought about this? This guy is slimy. Like I said, he's not telling the truth. And that's why you have two different stories. Now, we know that. It said right here in chapter 31, it said that Saul had been hit by the archers, had been wounded by the archers. The Philistines had been, slinging their arrows over into to the Israelite side there, and he got hit, you know, once or twice or a lot. Knew he was mortally wounded and knew that if the Philistines got a hold of him, they would make sport of him, they would abuse him, they would torture him or ridicule him or disfiguring or maiming him. And so he turned to his armor bearer and said, please kill me so I don't fall into their hands. Please kill me. Well, the guy was afraid. It says the armor bearer was afraid. And so what Saul did was he turned his sword upside down on the ground and fell into it. And the scriptures make very clear that he died there. It says, so Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, it says right there he was dead, he also fell on the sword and died with him. Thus, Saul died. That's how Saul, it's pretty clear. Pretty clear. Three paragraphs later, this Amalekite shows up and says, yeah, I came across Saul. I just happened to be on Mount Gilboa there in the middle of the biggest war of the century. Just happened to be there. And I just happened to be standing there when I saw all the Philistine chariots, you know, coming down. And I saw King Saul leaning on his spear. And he said, hey, you, come here. You know, the more you read this, you go, This guy isn't telling the truth. This isn't genuine what he's saying. Why would he say this? Why would he come across like this? Because, well, how honorable would it be if he told the real truth? Well, yeah, I was basically picking valuables off the dead, and I saw the king, who obviously killed himself, fallen on his own sword. And so I grabbed the crown and the bracelet. And, I mean, that doesn't go over very well. But when he realizes, wait a second, David was Saul's enemy. Word has it around Israel that David's going to be the next king. Man, I could think of how I could be exalted if I just come and say, hey, David, I killed your enemy. I killed Saul. And now I'm acknowledging that you're the king and I'm bringing you the crown and the kingly bracelet. And I brought it for you, my Lord. Boy, he's going to be made vice president of that new kingdom, isn't he? He's going to be exalted. He's going to be at least be rewarded. Well, not so. But my point is that this is clearly not a contradiction. And let me tell you, when people come off with that, oh, I don't believe the Bible, it's full of contradictions. I'll tell you what. I've been seriously studying the Bible for over 10 years. And I've never found a single contradiction. Not a single one. And so when somebody who said, yeah, you know, I went to Sunday school before, and they say, oh, the Bible's full of contradictions, just open up your Bible and say, could you show me one? Because I haven't found any either. Don't be smart alecky about it. Just say, hey, could you show me one? I'd be interested to see that. And maybe they'll turn to this, and you can explain to it, well, the guy's lying. Maybe they'll turn to something else, and you say, oh, boy, I never heard that. It sure does sound like a contradiction. I'll tell you what, I've run into plenty of things that sound like contradictions. But when you begin to understand what these things say, in reality, what they are showing you is two sides of a... Let me give you an example. The scriptures say, and I might be getting these numbers wrong because I always get these numbers wrong. As I recall, a certain plague struck Israel, and it says, and I'm pulling these numbers out of thin air, 186,000 of the Israelites died because of this plague that God sent upon them. Well, the Apostle Paul later on in the New Testament wrote and said, yeah, and, you know, remember that the Lord sent that plague and 185,000 of them died in one day. And you go, ooh, contradiction. See, the Bible said 186,000, but Paul said 185,000. Wait, is that what Paul said? No, Paul said 185,000 in one day. And so what that really tells you is the first day, 185,000 of them died. The next day, another 1,000 of them lingering on into life, they died. There's no contradiction there. And so the more places that you find that you go, wait a second, that's a contradiction, what it really does is it's usually educating you more. It's not a contradiction. The whole Bible is inspired by God, and you can trust that. Now, every once in a while, you'll get a copyist error in relation to Numbers. And I don't mean the book of Numbers, although there may be some in there. But if you knew how to read and write Hebrew, you would always have problems with the Numbers. You can look, it's very difficult. I mean, you miss a dot and suddenly it's 1,000 instead of 100, and then you miss, this or that. And it's easy to mess up numbers in Hebrew. And so sometimes you will find not things that weren't inspired, but things that when the guy is sitting there at his desk, you know, with a little shaved head and writing by candlelight, they just mess it up. And so you will find copyist errors. Almost always, 99.9% of the time, they're going to be regarding numbers. And again, I'm only talking about maybe a handful of things. 5, 6, 7 tops of these things. Contradictions? No, there's none of them. There's none of them. And you can rest assured in that. And if you don't know the answer, all you have to do is say, you know what? I've never heard that before, but let me check it out. Let me read about it. You know, let me read what you're saying is a contradiction, and I'll get back to you. I can assure you it's not. Because God wrote the Bible, and you can quote to him, all scripture is inspired by God. It's profitable for all kinds of things, you know, that Paul told Timothy. And you can rest assured. And then, you know, give me a call or call up somebody you know or study it out yourself. Or you want to know a really, really cool trick is there's people that know all the things that are supposed contradictions in the Bible. You just buy a book. You know, Geisler wrote When Critics Ask. It's a handbook it's handbook of Bible difficulties is what it's called. And it's great because somebody says, yeah, the problem in 2 Samuel there. Well, you turn to the 2 Samuel section and it says, you know, what is this a contradiction? You know, did Saul die two different ways here? And then it explains it. And so that's a real handy kind of book, an encyclopedia of Bible difficulties. Real handy book to have where you understand there's no contradictions there. So the guy says, well, yeah, you know, I happened upon Saul and I killed him and I brought you the crown and here's the bracelet. And so it says in verse 11, then David took hold of his clothes and tore them. So also did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord of the and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Interesting that in today's society, typically when people are depressed, they do one of two things. They eat or they go shopping for new clothes. Have you noticed that? And today is completely opposite from before. When they would be bummed, they would fast and tear their clothes. You know, just funny to see how things kind of go opposite there. Are you just laughing how stupid that wasn't me to say? So, so they mourned, and remember that Jonathan was David's best friend. I mean, you have never had a friend like Jonathan. You know, maybe you have, and hold on to that brother or sister, because that's a dear Christian friend. But you know, we read about Jonathan how he loved him like a brother, and just all the things that Jonathan did for David as a friend, and how reliable he was, and how trustworthy he was, and just what a great friend he was to have. And you can understand, hearing that he died, how bummed you would be. And the people of Israel, can you imagine it, hearing a war, hearing about, oh, how I imagine it was to be an adult in the days of Vietnam, when you're constantly getting reports back about how the neighbor kid, the 19-year-old, crossed the street, he was killed. And then your nephew, he was killed. And then your coworker, his son was killed. And then the guy at church, his nephew was killed. And you just hear it, and you're grieving. You're so sorrowful over it. And David and his men experiencing that, hearing that so many of these guys had been killed in this war, these people of the Lord. But what amazes me is that it says that David mourned until evening for Saul. If you don't mind the word, Saul was a jerk. Saul was psychotic. Saul was murderous. David did nothing but love Saul, and all Saul did was want to kill him. David would play the harp to minister to Saul, and Saul would throw a spear at him. David would lead the army to victory, and Saul would plot behind his back to kill him. Saul would pledge his, David would pledge his undying support to Saul and his kingdom, and all Saul wanted to do was off him, get him killed by trickery, or just directly, hey, I don't care if he's sick, bring down his bed and I'll kill him in his bed. That's how Saul treated David, and David mourned for Saul. David never did anything but love Saul. Is that amazing to you? I mean, if you've read through 1 Samuel, that should be amazing to you. If you've ever had an enemy of any kind, and you know, look how murderously angry we get when somebody gossips about us. Oh, don't you hate that? Isn't gossip about you the worst? It just hurts you so bad, and you wish the person was dead. Saul really tried to kill David. He gossiped about him too, made up stories, but David just kept loving him, kept submitting to his authority, kept praying for him. I don't get it. And see, that's what's really sad. That's what I find that's sad about my own walk, is that when I read this, I don't get it. And I think that's what you should be sad about your walk when you read this. You don't get it. We should get it. Jesus taught us how to get it. Jesus taught us real clearly. You've heard it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his son to rise on the evil and the good, sends rain to the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? You see, God loves people equally. See, if I was God, and there was a whole neighborhood of farmers, each one of them had 5 acres there, and I didn't like 2 of the farmers,
I'd make sure it never rained on their fields. I'd have, perfect abundance of rain, just the right amount of sunshine for the guys that I liked. But I would curse the ground of the farmers I didn't like, the farmers that hated me, so I hated them. It would never rain there. The sun would scorch anything that possibly grew. I'd make sure that tornadoes cruised in there and, you know, earthquakes and whatever else. But God, who we're supposed to imitate, God causes the sun to shine on the righteous and the wicked. God causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the wicked. And he's saying, follow my example. He says, if you only love those who love you, what good is that? Even the tax gatherers do that. And so, if the world, if the guy that works in the cubicle next to you, or the guy that sits in school in the desk next to you, He's a bad guy. He's smoking, he's drinking, he's cussing, he's out there doing things he shouldn't be doing, and he's big sinning and stuff. But you know what? The people that love him, he loves them. Can we say that we're any better? Can we honestly, and I want you to think about this. I'm not going to ask you to say anything out loud, but I want you to think about somebody that you genuinely do not like. Please think about them right now. I got a whole list. Maybe you have just one. Maybe you've got a whole list. Maybe it's your mother-in-law. Maybe it's your neighbor. Maybe it's the guy that caused you to get fired or whatever it is. Maybe it's just that gal that was in your last church that gossiped about you and made you have to leave or whatever it is, and you're mad. Think about that person. Now think about if you just got news that, man, they keeled over, had a heart attack right in the middle of the night, and you're thinking, they deserved it. God probably killed them. You're thinking, finally, now I'm vindicated. Thank you, God. But Paul said, love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. If your heart, if my heart, if our hearts are not like David's, that we would be so bummed, then we're not doing the right thing towards people that hate us, that gossip about us, that lie to us and that persecute us. We're not doing it right. We need to be praying for those folks, blessing those folks, loving those folks. And you'll know when you hear something bad happen. It's a good measurement for your heart, because you'll hear they lost their house in a flood, and you'll be like, all right. Or you'll be like, man, we got to bless them. We got to help them out. And your friends will go, well, she hated you. She gossips about you. She's never got anything good to say about you. Yeah, but the Lord loves her. And so I need to bless her. Interesting. So David mourned Saul. And if we're walking close to the Lord, we'll get it. We'll get it. David said to the young man who told him this Amalekite who came with this story, where are you from? He answered, well, I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite. Then David said to him, how is it that you are not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of the young men and said, go cut him down. So he struck him and he died. And David said to him, your blood is on your head. He's talking to this dead body now. Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Boy, if he was going to make up a story, that was the wrong story to make up and tell to David. Proverbs 19, verse 9, I think it is, says, a false witness will not go unpunished. He who pours out lies will perish. That's pretty literal, I think, you know. Gives you a reason to consider telling one of those little white lies that might make you seem cooler or put you in a better position. You know, he was struck down and died. Then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Yashar. The book of Yashar, does that sound familiar to you? You know, it's like right after Revelation in your Bible? No. The book of Yashar, it seems, was an account written down in songs or poetry of the day of the history of Israel. Much like the Bible was, except they said, hey, that's a good song about that battle. Let's put that in there. And so the book of Yashar was this, it included, as a matter of fact, in Joshua, I think it's Joshua chapter 10, but
It included, remember the long day of Joshua where the sun stood still in the sky? Well, that says, is this not written in the book of Yashar? So apparently this book, somebody checked it out from the Hebrew library, never brought it back because it's gone and we don't have it anymore. But so it was written down. And so don't you hate that? You know, you're on the waiting list and then the book never comes back. sorry. Someone was telling me today, I just got to share this. Someone was telling me they were on the waiting list for the latest Left Behind book, you know. And the waiting list is apparently really long. And he's like, it's like, man, you know, how many of these books do you have? And they said, one. Well, how many are you buying? We just bought that one. And he said he felt like going, how many of the latest Stephen King books did you buy? You know, it's interesting. I just had to throw that in. It had nothing to do with study. You know, thinking about it, if I had an axe to grind, I really could fit it in. You know, it's like if I wanted to grind an axe against the library, I could just talk about the book of Yashar and then just jump right in. Hopefully I don't do that a lot. So anyway, he begins to chant this lament. A lamentation is a song of mourning, M-O-U-R-I-N-G, the sadness, you know. And so David, being a pretty gifted songwriter, he's been writing songs since he was playing the harp there watching the sheep when he was a young teenager. He's been writing songs for a long time. And he says, I want everybody in Israel, everybody in Judah to learn this song. And it when you read it, you're just amazed. It says, your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. Who's he talking about? He's talking about Saul. The guy who tried to kill him. The guy who was psychotic. The guy who had forsaken the Lord in his kingdom. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. So you can see that David wants everybody to learn this song to remember Saul fondly, to remember that, oh man, he was the beauty of Israel. He was a mighty, mighty man. And he says, don't talk about this defeat. Don't go into the world and say, yeah, did you hear about that Philistine war, about how they... Don't tell that in Gath or Ashkelon. That was two of the five big cities that the Philistines had. They're basically two of their five capital cities. And he's saying, don't talk about this there, because all that does is make the uncircumcised, the unbelievers, the God rejectors rejoice in it. Oh, mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. It was on Mount Gilboa that Saul and Jonathan fell, that they died. And so David said, we should be mourning about this. And as a matter of fact, even the mountains of Gilboa should mourn, should rejoice, not even let the dew fall on them, not for them to be fruitful. And the interesting thing is, if you go to Israel today, you'll see that over the last, 4,000 years, the Jews have planted trees there. Literally millions of trees have been planted by the Israelites over the thousands of years. But Mount Gilboa, they've left naked, barren. Because of this, because King Saul fell and because David commanded it, you go there and it's this lush area, but then there's Mount Gilboa is empty. They have not planted trees there. They've not made it fruitful. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? And so he exalts them. He glorifies them. He says, you know what? Jonathan, when he saw the Philistines coming on, he didn't turn around and run away. He stood there and fought to the death. Saul's sword wasn't clean. You know, when he died, he had got his fair share of Philistines. And so he says, "Oh, daughters of Israel, you should weep over Saul." And then he says something that, man, it really bugs me when something that is so poetic and so sweet to the ears gets turned around for unrighteousness. And you probably know what verse I'm talking about. Verse 26, "My brother Jonathan, you've been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women." And guess what group has grabbed onto that? The homosexual agenda, you know, has said, "Oh yeah, this means that Jonathan and David were lovers, homosexual lovers." Because remember, it said in you know, chapter 26 or whatever it was of 1 Samuel, remember, it says that they kissed. Well, they kissed because they were weeping, they were mourning, they were never going to see each other again. They kissed as men in the Middle East do, not on the lips, not in a homosexual attraction, but in friendship. And you got to think about this for a second. David's saying, "Jonathan, your love to me was greater than the love of a woman." Well, what woman had David known love from? Michal, Saul's daughter, a liar, a betrayer. Remember, she had gone to the king, and the king said, "Why have you let David escape?" And she says, "Well, he threatened to kill me if I didn't help him escape." "Oh, thanks. Yeah, the love of a woman, that's great. Saul, or Jonathan, you know, man, he loved me with a real love." And so you can see the comparison there between Jonathan's love and Michal's love. He said, your love to me was more wonderful than the love of a woman. And so the song ends and chapter 2 begins. It says, "Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?' And the Lord said to him, 'Go up.' So David said, 'Where shall I go up?' And he said, 'To Hebron.' So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron." Now, think about David for a second. David's just heard that Saul's dead. David's living in, for the last 3 days, living in this burned down city of Ziklag. You know, all the buildings are burned down. He's got nothing keeping him here. He ended up in the land of the Philistines because he was backslidden in the first place, and now he's right with God. He's got no reason not to go back to Israel because Saul's dead, and so nobody's chasing him down to kill him. That's the reason he left in the first place. Common sense tells you, hey, bud, pack your stuff up and go. But what does David do? David inquires of the Lord. David asks God, "Shall I go up? Shall I go up to one of the cities in Judah?" And the Lord said, "Yeah." And then David doesn't pack up. He says, "Where shall I go?" He says, "To Hebron." Is your walk with God like that? Is your walk like David's walk? Do you look at what's plain, obvious, common sense, and say, "Well, of course, who needs to pray about that?" Or maybe you just don't even think about praying about it. You just do it. It's common sense. Lord gave me a brain. He gave me common sense, so I just do it. Or do you seek the Lord and honestly pray? When somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, brother, I noticed how you're working on the job there. What are they paying you?" "Well, they're paying me $9.50 an hour. I'll give you $12 an hour if you come and do the same job for me." Do you pray about that? A lot of people don't. A lot of Christians wouldn't. A lot of us haven't. It's common sense. Lord's opening a door, we say. Got to be careful about those open doors. You try and step through them and they slam on your toe. Do you take it because it's common sense, or do you pray about it like David prayed about it? And when you get an answer, do you pray for specifics? Are you walking in the dark? You know, God's word is a lamp unto our feet, a light to our path. And unless we're praying about stuff, unless we're inquiring of the Lord, unless we're reading the word and saying, "Lord, direct me. I don't want to be out on my own." And I can't tell you how many times since I've been a Christian, I don't like telling stories about, well, you know, all these lousy things I did before I was a Christian. Hey man, I want to be real with you. I don't want to set you up for some kind of pie in the sky. Well, once you become saved, man, you walk the straight and narrow, everything's perfect, you're on that razor's edge of God's truth, you never leave it. You know, if you ever sinned, you might want to question whether you're really saved or not. I don't want to do that to you. I want to tell you what I've done since I'm a Christian. And I've done some really stupid things. You know, I flew off to Las Vegas
in I don't know how many years I'd been a Christian, flew off to Las Vegas and went and got a job at one of the casinos as an art director. Can you believe that? I was a Bible student. I made excuses for myself. I said, well, you know, there's a lot of good Calvary chapels there in Las Vegas. And, you know, $40,000 a year is better than, you know, $26,000 a year. And, you know, not praying about it. It was common sense. The door was open. And that door was open. God stood, the angel of the Lord stood there with a flaming sword and said, if you walk through the door, I'll kill you. No, that was Balaam. I felt more like the guy that Balaam was riding. But I've done stupid things like that as a Christian. And it's stupid not because it's Las Vegas. Incidentally, how many people here have lived in Las Vegas? Okay, I apologize. Not because it's Las Vegas, but because I didn't pray about it first. See, I realized that it was a no after I prayed about it, because I prayed about it after. We got to pray about stuff. You got to pray about where you're going to move, what job you're going to take. You got to pray about what you're going to do tomorrow. You got to pray about this stuff. Inquire of the Lord. Don't make the excuse and go, well, it's common sense. It's plain and simple. No, it's not. It's not. So pray about this stuff. Seek the Lord. Be a righteous guy like David's being a righteous guy right now. So he moves up to Hebron there in Judah and says, then the men of Judah came there and anointed David king over the house of Judah. Remember, Judah was the biggest tribe of the 12 tribes in Israel. And so now he's king over Judah. Hey, isn't that great? And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul. And David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul, your Lord, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you. And I also will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. The men of Jabesh Gilead, probably good to get some good news. If you remember from our last study that they had not shown up for an important battle, and as a result, the rest of Israel came and killed most of the guys in the city, and then when they were afflicted, thought, man, nobody's going to turn out for us because we didn't turn out for them. You remember that from chapter 31 there. And the end of the book of Judges. But they were the ones that had gone and got Saul and Jonathan, his two brothers, off the wall. Remember, their bodies were hanging on the wall in the Philistine town square there in Beth Shan, I think it was, and came and gave them a proper burial, proper funeral there. And David said, hey, may you be blessed for doing that. And by the way, I'm the king now, and I want to bless you too. But Abner, it says, the son of Ner, Abner, the son of Ner, I like that. Commander of Saul's army had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim and made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. There's this kind of dual kingship thing going on here. Judah, the largest tribe there in the south, is being headed up by David. He's the king for 7 years. Well, 5 years into David being king, Abner, the son of Ner, you know, it's like Jeff, the son of F. Brian, the son of Ian. I like that. It's Abner, the son of Ner. Ner was Saul's uncle, and so Abner was Saul's cousin, and he was the commander of the army, and so for 5 years he continued to fight the Philistines and basically have this military rule here over the armies of Israel. But when Ish-bosheth, Saul's only remaining son, turned 40, they made him king, and so for the 2 years there, David was king over Judah, while Ish-bosheth was king over the rest of Israel. Now, Ish-bosheth was, remember, Ish-bosheth means man of shame. You know, so you can kind of get an idea about his character. His kingdom or his kinghood or his reign as king didn't go over very well. Not a lot of positive things to say about it. And they called him man of shame. That was Ish-bosheth was not his given name.
they called him man of shame. It was a play on words of what his other, his given name, what was that? It was Eshbaal. Eshbaal. So they called him Eshbosheth, but his real name was Eshbaal. And that wasn't much of a better name because that meant man of Baal. Remember Baal, Baal, the false god. That I don't know what Saul was thinking when he named that kid. You know, it's like you know, you guys have a kid and you say, call him, well, let's call him the son of Buddha. You know, what are you doing? That's not what you're naming him, right? Okay. All right. Wendy, you got that covered too? All right. No sons of Buddha here. All right. Well, they named him son of Baal, Eshbaal. So they started calling him Eshbosheth, or Ishbosheth, the man of shame. And so here's these kingdoms basically being paralleled here. And so Abner, the son of Ner, that cracks me up every time, went out from Mahanaim to Gibbon with the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibbon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. So it just so happens that they're here at Gibbon, and there's this pool, which, by the way, archaeologists have found, and I actually found a picture of it this morning. Neat-looking thing, a spiral staircase going down towards the water. But they happen to, the two commanders of the armies, you know, Abner, son of Ner, was the commander of the army of Israel, and Joab, he's the commander of David's army. Now, Joab is going to become a major player in 2 Samuel. In 1 Samuel, the first half of Samuel, he was only mentioned once, and he was only mentioned as the brother of the guy who went in with David. Remember, they snuck into the camp, and the guy says, oh, let me, Abishai says, let me run him through with a spear, and David said, no. Well, that was Joab's brother, so that's the only. So this is the first mention of him anyway. So the two commanders of these armies, one of Judah, one of Israel, meet up at this pool, and they've got a bunch of guys with them and stuff. And Abner said to Joab, now let the young man arise and hold a contest before us. See, they weren't at war. They weren't like officially enemies. Hey, we're all brothers, right? Well, there's that tension there. Oh, you made Ishbosheth your king, and we made David our king. And there's this tension here, and Abner, son of Ner, makes this contest thing, says, let the young men arise and hold a contest before us. And Joab said, let them arise. So they arose and went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called something. I'm gonna pronounce this right off the paper here. Chelkath Hatzurim. Okay? Chelkath Hatzurim. So the place was called that, which is in Gibbon. And that day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So they meet up at this pool. Abner says, hey, why don't we have a little sporting event? You know, a little contest, a little gladiator action. You know, 12 of my guys, 12 of your guys. Well, I guess what he didn't realize is David's guys have been out in the wilderness for years. They are literally mighty men. They are very well-trained warriors. And we see that because simultaneously they pull this move where, I mean, it's almost like synchronized swimming, how they all do it at the same time, you know? They grab the guy's heads, run them through, and the guys all drop simultaneously. These guys didn't know what hit them because David's men were, hey, they were mighty men. And so that obviously threw them for a loop. So the rest of the guys all go to war, and David's men just mop the floor with Ishbosheth's men, you know. And the only one alive at this point now is Abner. And it says that the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was swift-footed as one of the gazelles, which is in the field. So he could run fast. And Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. So Abner's the only guy living. He's running. And Joab's brother, Asahel, he's running fast. And Abner's running. He looks behind him and says, is that you, Asahel? And he answered, it is I. So Abner said to him, turn to your right or to your left. take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil. But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. And Abner repeated again to Asahel, turn aside from following me. They're having this conversation as they're running across the countryside. He says, turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear so that the spear came out his back. And he fell there and died on the spot. And it came about that all who came to that place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Abner honestly didn't want to kill this guy. He knew he had him. You know, he was carrying a spear. He knew that the guy was running so incredibly fast that all he had to do was turn around and hit him in the belly with it, and he'd go down. I don't think he was counting on it going all the way through. I don't know if he was even counting on killing him. But I know he was trying. He's going, you know, stop chasing me. Leave me alone. I don't want to kill you. But he wouldn't. So he turned around. He didn't even use the pointy end of the spear. Turned around and hit the guy in the belly with the spear, and he was coming at him so fast it went through. And so I'm not really defending Abner, son of Ner, but trying to give you an idea of how this has happened here. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. See, the two brothers, they were also chasing him, but they weren't swift as gazelles. And when the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Giah by the way of the wilderness of Gibbon. And the sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. So if you can imagine, you're chasing this guy, you're thinking, hey, it's two against one, it's two against one, it's 20 against two, it's 20 against two. So all these men of Benjamin here behind him, Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? So he's saying, look, guys, you know, we're all brothers here. We're all Jews. We're all Israelites. Don't make us kill you. You know, this shouldn't be happening. And Joab said, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother. In other words, hey, Mr. Big Mouth, if you hadn't said, let's have the young men have a contest, none of this would have happened. So Abner's sitting here playing Mr. Innocent, going, look, we shouldn't be having a war. And Joab's saying, look, you started this war. You know, you telling us to have a contest. So he says, so Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. Abner and his men then went through the Arabah all that night. And so they crossed the Jordan, walked all morning, and came to Mahanaim. Then Joab returned from following Abner when he had gathered all the people together. 19 of David's servants beside Asahel were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men so that 360 men died. Mighty men. You think when you have a war, 360 die on one side and 20 die on the other. You know, those are, I guess they're good odds if you, you know, talking about war, if there's ever good odds. And they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which is in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. So what this leads into now is a long period of war between David's men and Ishbosheth's men, between Judah and Israel. And it's not going to be until one of them dies. And I won't give it away. I won't tell you whether it's David that dies or the man of shame, okay? But until that's united, and I think that's in chapter 4 that you'll see which one of them dies, and like you don't know. So a lot of practical instruction in the first chapter for us to consider, and even in the second. But are you loving your enemies? I mean, it pretty much comes down to that. Are you loving your enemies? Are you seeking God for direction? Every direction, not just the biggies. Those, I think, the two major points, not to mention that third, little third one, if you're a liar, you're going to die. False witness doesn't go unpunished, does he? And, of course, a fourth point. I guess we had a four-point sermon, if you can ever count the points in these things.
5 points. Well, I forgot the whole thing about the library, you know. But, of course, the fourth point, of course, which has now just left my mind, and hopefully it hasn't left yours, that I can't for the life. Oh, contradictions in the Bible. There aren't any. So enough said about that. Let's bow our hearts in prayer.